Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We're joined by Rebecca Shelton, Policy Director at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg, to talk about a report that she co-authored with Eric Dixon from the Ohio River Valley Institute about housing damage from the 2022 Kentucky flood. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
In the weeks and the months following the flash flooding in eastern Kentucky last July, the number of homes destroyed or heavily damaged was unclear. There were a lot of numbers coming out. In this report, though, you put numbers on the loss. And first, how did you go about gathering the information and the data?
We use FEMA applicant data to calculate how many homes were affected by the flood and how severely they were affected. In terms of, you know, how high the water levels were in their homes. So the data on the number of damaged homes comes from that data set. So we feel pretty good about that, except for the fact that it's probably conservative. You know, there are people whose homes were affected who I'm sure did not apply for FEMA and thus wouldn't be captured in this analysis.
Well, it was recently announced that the Department of Housing and Urban Development, through its Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Program, will provide the flood-affected counties in eastern Kentucky with almost $300 million in relief funds. The funding can be used for a variety of things, including housing, and $300 million sounds like a lot of money. But only a portion of that funding goes to housing, and it doesn't come close to the need identified in your report. So to get a sense of that, let's dig into the analysis, and let's begin with Section 1, housing damage.
We looked at the FEMA applicant data over a 13-countywide area, and we found that nearly 9,000 homes were affected by the flood. Over 500 of those homes were destroyed, and we said that destroyed was either designated by FEMA as destroyed or by looking at the water levels and seeing homes that had water that was the second floor or higher. And then also over 4,500 homes sustained major damage. And major damage is conceptualized in our report as water levels that are on the first floor of a home that are at a depth that require, you know, floors to be replaced, baseboards to be removed, drywall to be replaced, you know, likely mechanical components in basements and crawl spaces affected. And those are, you know, costly repairs for those majorly damaged homes, you know, around $70,000 was our estimate across those for each home. And then the rest of that, you know, almost 9,000 were less severely affected homes, but they still require repairs of, you know, $20,000 to $30,000. And that's not a small sum of money for most people. We found that the homes that were affected, most of them were in, you know, Breathitt, Knott, Letcher, and Perry County. So a lot of the damage really concentrated in those four counties.
Well, Section 2 looks at the cost to rebuild, and you looked at two different approaches. So if first tell us about that, and then we'll get to the findings of each of these approaches in just a moment. But tell us about those two categories.
We conceptualize this range here, as you've described, as sort of a lower cost category that we actually conceptualized as what it would take to really repair homes in place for the most part versus moving more homes out of flood-prone risk areas. And so our two scenarios, we calculated the lower cost scenario, which was just moving the destroyed homes to new locations. So we would imagine in that case, you would have to rebuild a home and also buy some land for a home. And again, keeping our estimates conservative, we just said that rebuilding a home, it's going to be a rebuild. It's going to be 1,000 to 1,200 square foot. The cost of rebuilding that home and acquiring land would be about $185,000 for each home. And then all of the others, even those that sustained major damage, would just be repaired in place. Some, you know, in doing some repairs, maybe adding some mitigation options like flood vents and things to crawl spaces and basements, but really, you know, constrained to rebuild in place. The other scenario that we imagined was not only moving those destroyed homes to new areas, but moving the majority of the severely damaged homes into new areas as well. So of course, that increased the cost as we are, you know, not just repairing those majorly damaged homes at $70,000 each, but actually moving them into new areas and rebuilding for $185,000 each.
And I think when we get down to the bottom lines of each of those approaches, it puts that $300 million or portion of $300 million from HUD into perspective. So if you could give us those numbers. First, approach A, which is rebuild where we are, and approach B, rebuild safer homes.
For rebuild where we are, we estimated that it would cost $453 million. And for the other scenario, the higher cost scenario where we're moving more homes out of harm's way, would cost as much as $958 million.
Now, it seems like it's complicated, though, with something like 80% of the destroyed or the badly damaged homes last July were not located in officially designated floodplains. And we don't yet know where those floodplains are going to be. Is it possible to know where less flood-prone areas are?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think definitively that's hard for me to answer. I think, though, that there are absolutely areas that are less likely to flood, elevated areas. I mean, I think as most people who are listening have been to Eastern Kentucky at some point, and you know that the topography here is hills and mountains and the hollers and the valleys. And that's where a lot of people live right now, is in those valleys. And along, there's a lot of water here, a lot of streams, rivers flowing through those hollers. And so historically, that's where most of the homes have been built, is in those flat places. We do have higher land, so I think there is the potential to move folks into some of those higher areas, but it absolutely isn't easy. I think finding those lands and the ability to acquire those lands is going to be a challenge. And you could look at our figures and ask that question, and it's a good question. And I think there's a lot of folks who are actively trying to figure that out right now. Where do we build?
In Section 3 of your report, you look at incomes and demographics of flood-impacted families. And I'm wondering what you learned about who lived in these homes and their ability to pay for those repairs. As you mentioned, they can be quite expensive.
Yes, and I think this is the really critical and important part of this report, is acknowledging that the folks who were most affected have the least ability to recover on their own with the resources that they have. So we found that there is a higher share of low-income households among the homes damaged by the flood than among all household regions. And in other words, 60% of the households with damaged homes reported a gross annual income of $30,000 or less. And then in addition to that, you know, many are likely on fixed incomes. We had nearly 30% of the applicants with damaged homes were 65 or older. And we also found that the households with lower incomes have received less FEMA housing assistance, not more. So the FEMA, the median, looking at the median awards for households that reported $15,000 in annual income or $30,000 in annual income, is much less than the awards for households that are receiving $120,000 in annual income, for example. Lower income families are being hit the hardest and don't have access to the least amount of resources to recover. The other thing I'll add is that over a quarter of the people who are living in affected homes were under the age of 19. So we have a lot of young people for whom it's really critical to make sure that they are replaced in safe and comfortable homes for their health and their well-being and their ability to thrive in school. And otherwise, these disasters are going to have generational consequences.
Section 4 of your analysis breaks down damage estimates by county. And I'm wondering, is there anything that leaps off the page, anything in particular, after crunching those numbers that stands out to you?
Even if it's a higher cost decision, even if we are paying more to elevate homes or to find sites out of flood-prone areas, it's better for families and for people because the cost of human life is priceless. But it's also less costly from a pure dollar standpoint to do this right now. What gives me pause about this, about the county level estimates, is just that, you know, we can see that, for example, Breathitt County has been hit by flooding more than once in very recent years, and in a very small year, and then again the next year. And so just really hits home how important it is to do this right the first time, even if it costs a little bit more, just to make sure that we're giving people the resources to elevate their homes, to build their homes on higher ground if they're open to that, and to keep people safe, and to make sure that we are, over the long term, being efficient with the resources that we have.
Well, in your opinion, Rebecca, after looking at the numbers, are you satisfied that policymakers are doing enough to help Eastern Kentucky prepare for future extreme weather events?
What we've noticed is that planning for long-term and doing the work to mitigate and rethink where infrastructure is, rethink where housing is in tension with immediate response and relief. And I've just noticed that when we want to get people back into homes, back into schools, back into places as quickly as possible, sometimes the quickest path forward is just to go back to where we were, go back to the status quo, repair what was there, and then cross our fingers and hope for some good luck. But so I think that is just a challenge, I think, probably for any place facing disaster, is that doing something quickly is really needed. And also, oftentimes, it takes longer to really think about, well, how do we rebuild and restructure these communities? And so I do think that folks are trying to strike a balance there. What is really clear is just the tremendous lack of local level resources for recovery. I mean, so many of the counties here in Eastern Kentucky already are struggling to kind of pay bills and maintain public infrastructure before the flood. There was a housing crisis before the flood as well. And now the lack of resources has been a real constraint on what can we do locally to mitigate future harm.
All right. That's Rebecca Shelton, Policy Director at Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after the break, a code of ethics for journalism. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
I'm Brian Burkhart with coming events provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Danville's Art Center of the Bluegrass will host the Kentucky School for the Deaf exhibit and student show March 29th through April 29th. For more information, visit artcenterky.org. On April 4th at 6 p.m., the Appalachian Center for the Arts will present Brian Hertz's documentary film, Hazing. Learn more about the film and purchase tickets at theapparts.org. And on April 6th, Ashland's Paramount Arts Center will present An Evening with David Sedaris, beginning at 7 p.m. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit ParamountArtsCenter.com. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Brian Burkhart. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The need to know is as important as ever in a time when the delivery of often vital information is going through major challenges and changes. So we thought it would be useful to spell out the guidelines professional journalists operate within, namely the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. Joining me, Kentucky Journalism Hall of Famer Liz Hansen, a former president of the SPJ Bluegrass Chapter and a former member of the Ethics Committee of the National SPJ Board. She's been a reporter for newspapers in Arkansas and Louisiana and created and taught a media ethics course here at EKU. Also with us is Tom Eblin, now a freelance writer and photographer in Lexington and host of our series on Kentucky literature, formerly an opinion columnist with and managing editor of the Lexington Herald Leader. Tom, also a former SPJ president, previously worked for the Associated Press and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And so you're aware, I'm the current president of the local chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. So our Code of Ethics, Pillar 2. Under this pillar, we're told that journalists should balance the public's need for information against potential harm or discomfort, and pursuit of the news is not a license for arrogance or undue intrusiveness, And that might seem obvious, but in today's multimedia environment, what had been viewed in the not-too-distant past as outrageous behavior has become fairly common. To what extent do you attribute this to something of a clickbait arms race among news organizations?
One thing that I think attributes to it is that on news sites, and this drives me crazy, but on news sites, you have clickbait interspersed with the news stories in many cases. And some of that is absolutely outrageous, and I'm not sure readers always distinguish between what's the clickbait and what's the information coming from the news source.
It's very difficult to distinguish that often, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, also looking at it a different way, I think this kind of goes along with kind of what is now a standard practice of, say, victims of violence or particular sexual abuse are not identified. Some cases where someone's privacy would be invaded because they were a victim, the press is a lot more sensitive than they might have been in the past about identifying those people.
So we're talking about minimizing harm when we go about our business here. And the next point here is to show some compassion for those who might be affected by whatever it is we're covering. Heightened sensitivity when dealing with juveniles, victims of sex crimes, sources or subjects who are inexperienced or unable to give consent. Consider cultural differences in approach and treatment. Can you give me an example or two of judgment calls in this area?
One of the areas that there's been some controversy about, or was early on, is how people who chose not to get vaccinations and not to wear masks were treated by the media in some cases. They were vilified, and in some cases, and those were people who had died from COVID, and that coverage sometimes ignored the fact that these were people who had made decisions based on their own choices, and reporters sometimes did not explore what the basis of those decisions was.
One area where we see this is a lot is not identifying victims of sexual assault or other violence where the person is a victim, and identifying them would kind of thrust them into media coverage unfairly.
One thing that happens sometimes is you run into a conflict between pillars of the code, the obligation to seek truth and report it, and to minimize harm. And that sometimes makes for a difficult choice on the part of reporters. Do you harm one individual for the sake of the broader public? A case from here in Kentucky, a newspaper editor decided to publish the photos of everyone convicted of drunk driving in the county in order to bring down the number of deaths in the county from drunk driving. As a result, people whose photos were published were vilified, but it wasn't just them that were hurt. It was their families. And it had collateral damage beyond what just publishing that photograph might have done.
And that carries us into this next point, which is that we are to recognize that legal access to information differs from an ethical justification to publish or broadcast.
You know, I had an experience, a couple of experiences with that when I was a newspaper managing editor with something as simple as the property transfers. You know, the Herald Leader reports local property transfers, lists the names of the buyer and the seller and addresses as a matter of public record. It's public record at the PVA office. But I had a couple of cases where, for instance, a woman who had an emergency protective order against a significant other called and said, you know, please don't publish this because I don't want him to know where I'm living. In another case, I had a high-ranking judge say, you know, I've sent a lot of people to prison and I really don't want to have my address in the newspaper. And in both cases, we kind of made exceptions, and those were very rare exceptions, to not include a property transfer in the public record.
There's an older case in which a newspaper publisher in the Northwest, his policy was to publish everything that happened in court in his community, all the details, named all the witnesses, et cetera. And when there was a case involving a child sexual abuse victim, he covered the trial and named the child in his coverage. And he continued to justify it. He never backed down from that position. But I think most ethicists would say he had crossed a line there.
I think it's really interesting. This next point is to realize that private people have a greater right to control information about themselves than do public figures and others who seek power, influence, or attention. That can be a pretty subjective judgment call, correct?
Well, it's also a very tricky situation. We've seen a number of bills in the General Assembly that I think in many ways are well-intentioned, but they would kind of keep a lot of information out of the public realm that really the public should be entitled to. And many times these are under the guise of protecting police officers or whatever that are so broad and could be applied so broadly that a lot of valuable, important public information would be kept secret.
And there are cases where private people are thrust into the news inadvertently, not because of their own doing. I don't remember all the details, but there was a baseball fan who reached across the fence and caught a ball that otherwise might have changed the outcome of a baseball game. And when he was identified by the media, name published, et cetera, he received threats. He and his family were put in danger because he was identified.
Another one that I think is in the public mind quite often, and that's to balance a suspect's right to a fair trial with the public's right to know. That's a very difficult balance, and we're asked to consider the implications of identifying criminal suspects before they face legal charges, before they're arraigned. Should a suspect be identified before being charged?
I think it depends on the situation, and I worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution during probably the most famous case of this in recent years, which was the Atlanta Olympic Park bombing and Richard Jewell. And while I wasn't directly involved, I was like literally feet away from many of the decisions and discussions going on about this. And the Journal-Constitution decided to identify him when the FBI was at his apartment tearing it apart. You know, it was like the biggest crime in the world at the time. The FBI clearly had a suspect, and the Journal-Constitution named them. There's been a recent movie out about it, which is a very fictionalized version of that. One thing that the movie doesn't say is that the Journal-Constitution also reported that there's no way he could have done it because a reporter went from the place where the phone call was made to where the bomb was, and there was no physically possible way for someone to walk that fast. So, yes, the newspaper identified him, but it beat the police to saying that, you know, there's really no way he could have done it. And for that reason, while some news organizations did settle the lawyer Lynn Wood, who's since gotten in a lot of trouble for and a lot of sanctions for defending Donald Trump, the Journal-Constitution never settled, never dealt with that because they felt their reporting in that was accurate and fair.
And in some of these cases, nobody's ever going to be charged, even though there may be a suspect. And the exceptions that I think make sense is if a suspect is still at large, is considered dangerous to the public, and people need to be aware that this person could be dangerous and could cause them harm.
In this increasingly digital age that we live and work in, we are to consider the long-term implications of the extended reach and the permanence of publication or broadcast of a news story. And we are to provide updated and more complete information as appropriate as we go along. And we're beginning to see that happen quite often now with established publications like the New York Times, I noticed. They update as a story is breaking. That kind of changes the game, doesn't it?
It does. There's also a danger, though, of, you know, some stories will be a big story and then another big story will come up. And there's not always the follow-up you have there. It's interesting. There's some legislation that's been bouncing around in some European countries of, you know, do people have a right to be forgotten? And, you know, should news coverage be expunged after a few years, which I think is in a lot of ways a dangerous trend in some ways. But that is something that is a real controversy now in the internet age and a digital age in which really you have access to, you know, news reports going back more than a century.
All right. Thanks to veteran journalists and ethics professors Tom Eblin and Liz Hansen. We'll be back next week with a look at Pillar 3 of the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. And again, if you would like to read the full document, you'll find it on our homepage at esweku.org. Kentucky Student Voice Team was launched just over a decade ago, and in that time, KSVT has done much to get the adults who are making decisions that impact students to listen to the needs, views, and ideas of students. The ultimate aim is to engage youth in community and civic life. Ramona Pierce, senior at Danville High School, is the KSVT Press Corps Coordinator, and she's here to talk with us about student journalism. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ramona.
Thank you so much.
So I'd like to begin by asking you to make the case for student journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of times when I'm thinking about student journalism and trying to make the case for it, I think about what we're missing without it. So I think that often it's overlooked how much expertise students really truly have about their own education, which can be surprising. But I think we're definitely in a time when education decisions, education discourse is very polarized. And I think that these issues need to be thought about with a lot more complexity. And I think that prior knowledge coming into these discussions is really, really crucial. And I think that students bring that to the table in so many ways.
Do you find that the people at the table, the adults that you're interacting with, benefit from hearing from students about their experiences?
Absolutely. I think that when students are meaningfully listened to, I think that adults stand to benefit a lot. I think that communities as a whole, education communities and communities in general, benefit from all participants having a voice. I think that oftentimes the opportunities that students are given to have a voice are very performative or are kind of rooted in tokenization. But I think that when we're given the opportunities to be meaningful participants and participants with agency, I think that that's when we see the best and most important results.
Well, you know, when I introduced you, Ramona, I said that you were with the Kentucky Student Voice Team. And I think it'd be interesting to a lot of our listeners who are not familiar with that to hear a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, of course. So the Kentucky Student Voice Team is a group of self-selected students from across the state. It's a broad organization, and we do a lot within it. So my role is within the journalism, storytelling side of things. But within KSVT, we're students from across the state advocating through policy and working to conduct research. We have a podcast. So many different means that kind of share the goal of advancing student autonomy, student power, student voice in all decision-making spaces.
Well, I know that you're not just a member of this group, but as the Press Corps coordinator and the editor of the new EDU, you also play an important role in what the group does around student journalism. What does journalism look like for the Kentucky Student Voice Team? Can you describe how and why you do what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So journalism for the Kentucky Student Voice Team, we have a history of being involved in journalistic endeavors. Kentucky Student Voice Team members have been publishing op-eds and publishing articles for a long time in outlets across the country. But our journalism work has evolved in recent years to really center on the new EDU, which is our journalism platform. And that's where I work with our press corps, a group of students from across the state, to skill build and build community in a way that uplift journalism within our organization and across the state. And our means of doing that is our platform of the new EDU. So the students that I work with ultimately are publishing on that website.
And what are some examples of coverage?
Recently, we've had a lot of coverage on some of the bills from the legislative session. Some of the recent pieces that I've seen, we had a student write about a bill that would provide free menstrual products for students. We had, for Student Mental Health Week, we had two really powerful op-eds on that. We had a student who was involved in our fellowship write about curriculum violence in schools. So we have students writing about all sorts of topics.
And are students going out and doing interviews and that kind of thing?
Yeah, they are. So a big part of the work that I'm doing and that we all hope to do with the new EDU is helping students be involved in all steps of the article writing process, which of course includes going out and finding great interviews with people that will enrich the pieces that the students write.
Well, we're in the middle of a time of major societal transition going on right now. We've got an older generation of news consumers who have been accustomed to the paper newspaper, mm-hmm. to appointment broadcast news, TV or radio, but are now also pretty much immersed in digital forms. Mm-hmm. They're sharing space and time with multiple younger generations of digital natives and relatively non-analog mm-hmm. people who are accustomed to 24/7 access to this mind-boggling menu of on-demand information options. How, in your view, is technology like this, digital technology, reshaping journalism?
So I think that digital technology, I mean, it's evident that it's reshaping how we've thought about journalism for a really long time. It's kind of changed the entire field for better or for worse. But I think that a lot of the discourse around that, like, kind of sometimes asks young people to answer for that entire phenomenon, which I think that we should definitely be partners in that discussion. But I think that young people's, the way we interact with journalism, digital and otherwise, I think is not often. I know people who are diving deep into social media journalism, but I also know student journalists and student writers who are really invested in print media and in bringing back paper magazines, like print literary magazines and other forms of media that we kind of think of as being in the past. So I think that young people are, more than people are giving them credit for, exploring the means of which, like, a future of journalism can include like a diverse array of media formats, I guess.
Well, you work as an editor, so you know what you can catch in a piece of copy that comes your way that needs to be shaped and corrected or revised. Citizen journalists, social media journalists, as you mentioned, virtual reality journalists, or combinations of those disciplines, are often working independently with zero editorial oversight. Should we be concerned about that?
That's a difficult question, but I do think that, I don't know if I'd say concerned, but I think that it's something to pay attention to. And I think that it's something where good journalism, or at least the best journalism I've encountered, doesn't occur in a vacuum. And that's why I find a lot of meaning from the work that I do being very collaborative. But I think that independent journalism, freelance journalism, all the things you were talking about, I think they have a role to play in the journalism world. And it's going to be a different role than how we think of when we think of, like, newsrooms and newspapers. But I do think that bringing to the forefront the best discourse and the best journalism is always going to involve collaboration of some sort, and multiple sets of eyes on a piece is really important.
You know, there was a time when the public generally placed a lot of faith and a lot of trust in news media, a lot more than they do today. There's a report from Gallup and Knight that finds a widening gap between what Americans expect from the news media and what they think they're getting. They are losing confidence in the idea of an objective media as perceptions of bias grow. And I'm interested in how the next generation of working professional journalists views the concept of objectivity.
The conversations around bias and objectivity in journalism are really inescapable no matter where you go. And that's because they're very important, and they're complex, to be sure. I think that when I talk about bias and objectivity with the students that I work with, fellow student journalists, adult journalists, a lot of what we return to is that many of us believe that bias is inescapable, and that when we recognize our bias and do our best to recognize our bias in all forms, that we become better journalists because we understand the broader forces that are at work in the words we write, whether that's underlying or very clear. I think that telling the truth in journalism is always going to be central, and I think that often that gets separated from recognizing bias and interacting with the ways bias affects our pieces. But I think that you can value just the absolute importance of truthful and hard-hitting fact-based journalism while also thinking critically about bias and the way that one person's attempts at objectivity will be shaped by that.
You mentioned thinking critically, and I think that's something important to kind of zero in on here, how being engaged in student journalism actually strengthens that muscle, your critical thinking, because that's what you got to do, isn't
it?
What are some important challenges that are faced by student journalists?
There are so many challenges faced by student journalists. Student journalists, even when student journalism programs were more robust across the state, faced real serious issues with censorship from administrators, from outside forces. I love working with an independent publication because we get to sidestep some of that with our student journalism work, not having to necessarily answer to school administrations. So that's the right side of it, and that's been an issue for a long time. And now we're also working with the challenges of access to journalism opportunities. So, like, becoming a journalist through Kentucky Student Voice Team was the only means that I was really able to get deeply involved in student journalism. As I'm someone who doesn't have a newspaper in my school, it's been difficult for me to even try to write for local papers due to, like, leadership shifts and just the instability of it. I think that some of the biggest challenges we face are simultaneously protecting the rights and autonomy of student journalism and the respect of it, while also just making sure that it's available to begin with.
You recently joined forces with students from other high schools and published a commentary that was published in a lot of Kentucky newspapers that drew attention to the state of scholastic journalism in Kentucky and this thing called the New Voices Act. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was some legislation that Brennan Eberwein, the editor-in-chief of the Manual Red Eye, and Cooper Bass of Bullet East Livewire, they've been working hard with along with other people to introduce, and they did successfully get it introduced. It's a piece of legislation, the likes of which have been passed in a handful of other states, and it's been introduced in Kentucky legislation before, but it has yet to be passed, that would codify student rights in addition to the rights of sponsors for student journalists. While a lot of the kind of advocacy that I do is centered around making sure journalism rights exist to begin with, I think that there's a really clear connection, because when student journalist rights are ensured and guaranteed by law, I think that students and teacher sponsors who are really critical in this sort of thing are much more likely to dive into this work.
When students recently staged a walkout at Danville Independent to protest legislation that they felt unfairly targeted trans people, you shared that story in a Twitter thread that was seen by more than 100,000 people, and it was shared widely. Can you talk a little bit more about the experience of reporting live from school that day?
The two students at my school who organized the protest are Sam Wilson and June Wagner. They worked really hard. They did amazing organizing work to mobilize our student body. It was completely student-led, and they reached out to me because they knew I was involved with student journalism stuff to see if there was some way that I could publicize it to ensure that it echoed beyond just our school community. And I wanted to do my best to amplify the amazing work that they were doing. So that day, I reached out to some reporters. I was hoping some other people would cover it, and which they did, and the response was amazing. But just to be safe, I wanted to cover it on my own, too. And I don't think that social media is often the best way for stories to be covered, but I think for breaking just in the moment sort of events that have a lot of energy, it can be a really powerful tool for just capturing it and sharing it widely. It was a cool surprise to see it take off as much as it did. And I hope that it continues to serve as a amplifier and a reminder of the amazing work that Sam and June and students like Sam and June continue to do in schools. And I hope that it also kind of serves as a reminder that this sort of stuff happens all the time, and that it often goes unreported, and that when it does go to report it, it has massive implications.
Well, I've known 16-year-olds who were a heck of a lot more mature than some of the 20, 30, or even 40-year-olds I've known. So don't get me wrong here. I don't mean to be condescending, but how would you respond to an adult who says, these are kids, they're not yet fully formed, they lack the depth of perspective or experience that they should have to be writing about issues and so forth? What would you say to that?
Yeah, so I think about that a lot. I think that that's a common criticism that people bring up. And I think that part of the answer does lie in what you brought up in the first place, that age is not often or always the measure of maturity. But I do think also that especially when we're thinking about students having agency in spaces where they are directly impacted, I don't think age should be even close to one of the top things that we're thinking about as a qualifier for being able to make decisions and having agency in these spaces. Because no matter what age group you're talking about, once you get to a certain age, I think even for students, when you're talking about things like education, it's honestly a little ridiculous to me when people say that students shouldn't have a voice in the thing that they truly do, in my opinion, for the most part, understand better than adults who are years or decades removed from it. I think that people surprisingly underestimate how well students do understand the dynamics, the complexity, the realities that occur and overlap within schools, and I think are able to give input on that in a much more powerful way often than a lot of adults who aren't present in a school building for 35 plus hours a week.
All right. Well, let's say that I'm listening to this and I'm a middle or a high schooler and I want to do this. I want to write news. I want to write commentary about what's going on in Kentucky mm-hmm. education. How do I get connected with you all? How does the Kentucky Student Voice Team's press corps work?
I would say that if you want to, you definitely should. And you can go to our website, ksvt.org, and there's an email on there that you can email for the new EDU, and we'll be in touch with you really promptly about getting on in our communication circle and getting you on our Zoom calls and just giving you all the tools you need to be a contributor to the new EDU.
All right, that's Ramona Pierce, Danville High School senior, and she is Kentucky Student Voice Team Press Corps Coordinator and editor of the new EDU. Thank you, Ramona.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Begley is back with an essay on the power and responsibilities of being a local reporter.
I first worked as a journalist for the Mountain Eagle newspaper in Whitesburg. I had moved back there from Chicago, where I was in graduate school, to spend time with my grandparents. I wrote a letter to the editor, and one thing led to another, and I ended up writing for them on a regular basis. I covered fiscal court meetings, city council meetings, and also did some features about what a particular policy might do to the community or the potential impacts of a proposed change. I loved writing for the newspaper. I liked finding the stories and going out and talking with people, and even the research that was necessary to contextualize a story. I liked the immediate feedback. On the day that the paper came out at the diner downtown at lunchtime, people would talk about things I'd written. It felt like it mattered. I began to realize just how important journalism could be. I didn't expose anything of great importance to the community, but there was a long history of journalists doing just that. Watergate was broken by reporters. So was the Pentagon Papers, the Iran-Contra affair, and the extent of abusive priests in Boston. And with that power, of course, comes the responsibility of doing it right. Sometimes those responsibilities became very apparent. I remember reporting on a contentious issue from a city council meeting and how difficult it was to condense 2 hours of arguments into a short newspaper article that did it justice. I was lucky to have two great editors, the legendary Pat and Tom Gish, who kept me straight and taught me how to do it right. They made me rewrite articles to get more input from the other side, to be more rigorous and complete. They gave me a book with a journalistic code of ethics in it, and it was clear to me that their standards were high, and I had to get it right. Finding the truth and reporting it, being fair and balanced or being unbiased, doesn't mean you come down in the middle of every contentious issue. It means you follow the facts, pay attention to ways that you may be biased, and take great effort to make sure that you have all sides of the argument. But what about those of us who are consumers of journalism, not journalists ourselves? We know some reports are wrong and inaccurate and even misleading on purpose. So how do we remain skeptical or critical without being dismissive? I ask the same questions I would as a reporter. What is the evidence? Do the conclusions follow from that? Is there an obvious political agenda? Who funded this? What stories are being reported and what stories are being left out? And how does that coverage compare to other sources? I don't believe something just because I hear it, but I don't dismiss it because I don't want to hear it. It takes some work to build trust and to know who to trust, but it's worth that effort.
You can find Chris Begley essays on our site, esweku.org. Renovation of the Giles Art Gallery on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University is almost done, and gallerist Melissa Vandenberg is getting ready for a reopening. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Melissa.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if you would, give us some background on the Giles Gallery.
The Giles Gallery is in the Campbell Building on the campus of Eastern, and it opened originally in about 1973 upon the building completion. And it was always a gallery, but it's been 50 years since it opened, and it's been overdue for renovation. And we're lucky enough to have had the investment, and we're reopening soon.
So what's changed? What have you done?
complete facelift. In the 70s, it was pretty common with university art galleries to have carpeted walls. So we are reopening with fresh white drywall, no more brown carpeted walls, which will do a better job at highlighting the artists and the work on display.
Let's talk about the reason for there being an art gallery on a college campus. What is the mission and the purpose of a university art gallery?
Well, university art galleries across the U.S. and college campuses are a pretty common occurrence. We're lucky at Eastern to have a gallery space that was always meant to be a gallery versus a retrofitted space. Our general mission is to, first and foremost, to support the creative research and scholarship of faculty and staff and students at Eastern. But we also want to bring artwork and design to campus that otherwise wouldn't be available to the students and faculty and community in Richmond.
Let's talk about art itself and the academic experience. It's not all just about learning to be an artist, is it? Why is art important, or what is its role in the scholarly pursuit?
Well, as in the scholarly pursuit, sometimes it can feel a bit out of sorts because people don't typically associate it with scholarship with a capital S. I, of course, would beg to differ. Besides gallery spaces like this offering community enrichment, entertainment, an enriched cultural landscape for the surrounding community, it also does a job at presenting not just beautiful works, but sometimes challenging works. And that's typically the role of a lot of university art galleries nationwide. They reflect the times that the work's being made in, and when they're curated well, it's going to have a diverse range of work on display, too. We focus at Giles specifically on living artists primarily, and of course supporting student exhibits, BFA research, and faculty research on campus and sharing that with the community.
And you mentioned the surrounding community, so the gallery is open to everybody in Richmond and Berea and around there?
Yeah, all our programming is free and open to the public unless otherwise noted. It's been that way since its inception, so there's no RSVP needed, no ticket prices. We pride ourselves, along with a lot of other university art galleries, on having accessible programming, and keeping it free and public is really important to those missions. Besides representing those on the Eastern campus and the immediate surrounding community, we hope to actually reach out to the entire Southeast and bring in artwork from other states as well. It's easier to bring one artist or design collection to our venue than it is to send a bunch of Kentuckians elsewhere. So it's really efficient at exposing folks to research done outside our immediate surroundings.
Well, an awful lot of time these days is spent in the virtual world. And I just wondered if you could talk to us about why it's still important to experience art in real time and in place.
Well, obviously, the pandemic really heightened our skill set when it came to experiencing art and design virtually. Our space, like a lot of others, had to shutter for some time, and we had to pivot with our programming and how research was shared. The in-person experience, though, even with digital works, with new media works, is still super important. The sensory experience when you're in person, face-to-face with material and discipline, creatively speaking, is irreplaceable. It does not mean that we devalue the virtual experiences we have, but the in-person experience is just different, and we want to make sure they're equally valued as we move forward embracing more technology.
Well, I was wondering if you had concerns about the application of AI, artificial intelligence, for example, in creating art, or do you see opportunities for artistic innovation and creativity in these new technologies?
Technology is a wonderfully loaded word. Paint is a form of technology, to be totally honest. So as rudimentary or fundamental as you are with how you define that word, for me, NFTs, AI, regardless of the modality that we're practicing within, it is simply another tool, and it's up to the users to use it ethically, progressively, and ideally with a degree of originality. But artists have usually been pathblazers when it comes to new tech, appropriating it hopefully in the right ways to be thoughtful and impactful as we look at adding it to our arsenal of media. Not all that different than carved stone, paint on canvas, pencil on paper. It just might be in the form of time-based media or pixels.
Back to the in-person question, I wonder if you could describe for us, if it's possible to do this, what happens when a group of students gather in a gallery versus online viewing of art? What kind of synergies and what's going on in there?
Yeah, good question. The group experience in a gallery can, for the first time for students, can sometimes be a little intimidating, to be totally honest. We want to create an accessible environment, but it's also not necessarily to be viewed as a quiet space, as one might interpret. I want people to enjoy themselves when they're around works of art and design. So that in-person experience, particularly as a group activity, my hope is that it's an extension of the classroom, one that's handled well, and that students will have conversations, not just with me, but with each other when they're in the space, and that they'll want to return. So making it almost comfortable so that they don't feel out of place, that they know they belong in spaces like this and spaces with art, is really important to the educational experience.
So to get rid of the intimidation factor.
Absolutely.
Well, what are we going to find when the gallery reopens?
When we reopen, I think we've done a good job planning an exhibit featuring past and present faculty members. The title of the exhibit is Giles Gallery Golden Grand Opening. That's an awful lot of G's, but we're worth it. We're featuring 24 past and present faculty members. And I was doing some math earlier today amongst the 24 of us that are exhibiting. And cumulatively speaking, as educators, that's over 360 years of teaching experience in those 24 exhibitors. I will stress this does not represent all of our past and present faculty, but we're going back to about 1969 as far as representation is.
And I heard you say us. Are you?
Yeah. Normally, I would not be part of a show as the gallery director in a gallery that I'm running. But as a faculty member, I'm really, really honored to exhibit along with my past colleagues and my present peers.
So the opening is on March 31st.
Correct. Friday, March 31st from 5 to 8 p.m. And opening receptions with gallery venues, they're open house, so people can come and go as they please. But the exhibit will be up March 31st through April 19th. So if you don't make it to the reception, I urge people to come on out during one of the other days.
And you're also on Facebook and Instagram, I understand.
Absolutely. You can find us at EKU Giles Gallery on Facebook and Instagram, and you can visit our website at art.eku.edu.
All right. This gallerist, Melissa Vandenberg, on the March 31st reopening of the Fred Parker Giles Gallery on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for supporting the arts.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the coming edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and Google News. Our RISE series about Eastern Kentucky flooding and more is available online at weku-rise.org, also on Spotify and Apple Music. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.